Welcome, everyone, to Selling the Cloud, the podcast where we decode the art and science of B2B selling in the ever-evolving world of SaaS. I'm your co-host, Mark Petruzzi.
I'm Kathy Minter, and I'm thrilled to be part of this conversation. Our goal every week is to deliver insights, explore these innovations, and hear both real-world and personal experiences from amazing leaders from across the industry.
Hi, and I'm Paul Melcuri, excited to dive deep into the minds of some of the best and brightest thought leaders in the SaaS sales space, the ones that have built this market from its embryonic stage to the trillion-dollar industry it is today.
Welcome to today's episode of Selling the Cloud podcast. Today, we are joined by my good friend, Andy Paul, who is considered amongst the most respected authors, speakers, and advisors on B2B sales effectiveness globally.
Good. And today, Andy, great to have you on the podcast. Thanks, Mark. So, you know, today we want to explore a couple areas. I think one, from your background, obviously, like, how has sales in the B2B space kind of evolved into the, you know, SaaS and beyond? So it's like, what is the evolution looking like? Also, obviously, everything AI today. So how it was overused in a lot of ways, but sort of how should realistically teams be thinking about AI when they think about their sales strategies? So I know there's a couple areas we want to dive into there. And then really leadership in sales and scaling teams in today's world. So those are some of the main topics. And back to you, Mark.
Great, Andy. So we'd love to hear a little bit of your backstory of your career leading up to being a guest here today on Selling the Cloud.
Yeah, everything's been prologue to being a guest here on the show. So this is it, right?
This is how you know you made it, Andy.
Exactly right. Yeah. Gosh, yeah. It's 23 years in a variety of tech sales roles, starting selling big computer systems, on-premise computer systems, back in the day when those things they existed in a different form. I worked at Apple in the very early days of Apple, primarily in channel sales and channel marketing. And then sort of started my journey through startups after that. Worked for, gosh, the company made the first battery-powered notebook computer, which was a great product, but a glorious failure. And then got involved with some startups in the satellite communications industry, which is where I spent 15 years selling large, complex satellite communication systems to large enterprises around the world. And sort of the theme in my career had been, as I joined startups, either where they're in need of a turnaround or a restart or sort of first person in type roles and help grow. And my expertise really was, geez, how do you as a small, no name, no brand name, no track record company go compete against the biggest companies in the world to win orders for mission critical systems? So I started my own company to work with other companies, to small companies, help them learn how to go out and compete for big deals. And gosh, did that for a number of years. Since about 2015, I started my own new podcast. It was when that was still so early in the game. And along the line, I published a couple books and gosh, we produced, my son and I, who is my co-founder in that, we produced about 1,200 episodes of that podcast. It was acquired a few years ago. And we started a new podcast this last year, 2023, the Win Rate podcast. So yeah, that's sort of me in a perhaps too big of a nutshell.
Andy, something you said earlier, just for my own curiosity, when the first battery powered notebook computer, obviously someone came in after and made, you know, the next generation of that product. And I'm curious, in those, when you see an evolution like that, and was sales part of that next company for being successful? You know what I mean? If there was a fail, when you said it was a miserable fail, I'm curious.
It wasn't a sales issue. I mean, in 1984, we had a $150 million backlog. So that's probably better part of $750 million in backlog in today's dollars that we had pre-sold the product because it was the only thing of its type. The problem was it was too much too soon. And underlying technology, CMOS technology, you know, very small package. CMOS technology was just starting to be introduced at that time. It wasn't in wide commercial use. It was one of the first commercial uses of 3.5-inch floppy drives. You know, it was just, they're pushing the envelope in so many directions. But sort of the killer was, is that they had designed the whole system around a proprietary OS that looked a lot like sort of the early Mac OS. So, and then all the clients said, well, we really want DOS. Mm. And the motherboard was constrained at that time, given this the footprint, to a very small amount of RAM by today's terms. Then we're talking about, you know, 64K or 96K. And DOS required like 128K just to boot. And they just, yeah, you know, the product just, at that time, the technology didn't exist to make that product. And in a couple of years, it did. And it was really a shame because I said, we sold the crap out of that thing. I mean, it was, everybody wanted it. Government, enterprise. My job was, I was setting up all the retail distribution through the retail computer stores that existed at that time. Everyone wanted it. I mean, it was just.
It's interesting to think about just reflecting on that. And I know we want to jump into a bunch of topics, but AI, and when you say like they just weren't ready for it, or it was too much, or in today's world. So it's interesting to look at those parallels from years ago, which kind of can be the same in some of the things we're trying to do in today's world, right? And which, you know, how do you sure. know how to simplify the message? And I think that goes kind of to our first topic around the evolution, how things are evolving, right, from where they were to today. And some of the things stay the same and a lot of things change. I'm curious to get kind of your thoughts on that macro level view.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's, you know, the classic French saying is, you know, more things change, the more they're the same. And unfortunately, I think that's sort of been the arc of sales over the last 15, 20 years and sort of this golden age of sales technology. Is arguably sellers have become worse at selling over that period of time. I mean, there's certainly data that supports that. And the question is why would that be the case? And is that still going to be the case as we start embracing AI and integrating, you know, parts of AI into what we're doing in sales? And I think one of the issues has been, is among several issues, but, and I think this is, you know, potential pitfall, what we're seeing the way AI is being implemented so far, is that it's all about the seller. You know, everything's about the seller. Well, sales takes two, right? It takes a buyer and a seller. And, you know, the more that we focus on us as sellers, the less effective we become with the buyers. And again, we're seeing that in spades with the data that says, hey, 75% of B2B buyers don't want to talk to salespeople. And it's not because there's an alternative technologically that makes it so simple. It's because the buyers get nothing in return for the time they invest in sellers in too many cases, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, survey after survey, you know, talk about, you know, 75% of sellers show up and, or buyers, 75% of buyers say sellers show up unprepared to talk about the things that are of importance to the buyer. And they just know how to pitch a product. And so we've had all this, as I said, starting with CRM leading up to, you know, literally hundreds and thousands of companies that introduced sales technologies, applications, hasn't moved the needle in terms of win rates, in terms of quota attainment. Again, that's multifactorial. It's, you know, can't blame it all on one thing, but certainly there. And this massive buyer dissatisfaction with sellers. You know, it's problematic. So when we look at, okay, we're going to start utilizing AI in various forms, whether it's a guided selling application or a sales assistant of some sort and so on, you know, are we repeating the same errors that we've repeated with sales technology, which is, you know, if we look back 10 years, if we go 10 years in the future and look back, we're going to say, oh gosh, we really missed an opportunity with AI to really use this in a way that really benefits the buyer, which in turn benefits the seller.
You know, Andy, what's interesting with all that as well is even when we identify the buyer and we say, okay, let's go into this customer journey type of process, we most companies, we mess that up as well, because we overcorrect, and it's all about the customer journey. And, you know, that's, I mean, there's some value in understanding a little more what the customer is looking for and what it feels like on their, on that side. But, you know, that's one thing that I feel like we miss all the time. And then the other thing, to your point, you know, you clearly pointed out that buyers really only see their sales reps doing one thing, and that is pitching a product. And I've almost moved to a point that pitching a product is almost completely irrelevant in today's selling.
Oh, yeah, product. Absolutely.
Because they're such commodities, right? And they're also such, there's so much information out there. Many cases, the buyers know more than the sellers do about the real features and functionality about a product.
And to that point, though, is the buyers don't think that's that important. Yeah. Right. I mean, that's the other thing, is there's been a series of studies done through win-loss analysis of buyers. One company in particular whose data is really strong is a company from Australia called Trinity Perspectives, where they've interviewed thousands of enterprise buyers over the last dozen plus years. And a little over a year ago or so, they summarized their findings over all these interviews into 9 reasons why you win deals and 9 reasons why you lose deals. And product and price weren't among the 18 reasons.
Yeah.
So it was all about the human aspect of the sale and the buyer experience and the trust and the connection and the emotional connection, the ability to, you know, create a vision of success for the buyers. I mean, in one of the 9, one of the 18 reasons win loss was price, and it was the price was too cheap. So, you know, when you're in an environment where, and I'm sort of estimating these numbers but there was a post that somebody had put out a few weeks ago on LinkedIn about a guy had gone into G2 and counted the number of companies selling conversational intelligence packages. It's like well over 150. The number selling sales engagement software applications, maybe double that number. You know, you go through these categories, there's literally hundreds of companies all competing for the same piece of the pie. And it's like, if you're a buyer, you just assume, right? It's a given. It's table stakes. I'm talking to you, you've got a competitive product, a competitive price. So where's the differentiation? What's the reason I should buy from you versus somebody else? It's not product. it's not price. So what is that? Well, in the minds of the buyer, is, you know, these studies have shown, and Gartner's had the same studies and so on. It's trustworthiness. It's adaptability to the way you sell, to the way we need to buy, and the way we need to make our decision. It's not the product and price. And so the goal for AI should be, how do I help in those dimensions, right? How can we use AI to help a seller build a human-to-human connection with the buyer? How do we help use AI to help a buyer or a seller to build trust, a level of trustworthiness with buyer, establish their credibility? I mean, that to me is the real opportunity that potentially could move the needle. If we're just using it as so many of the initial applications are, using it as, not all of them, but some, many of them, as sort of ways to get buyers or sellers to do more things, more activities, you know, then sure, we're going to all use it, but it's not going to be helping the buyers. And we're not going to change the situation we're in, where the buyers look at sellers as, you know, more of a bother than a help.
Yeah, and I don't think many people are thinking about AI in that way, which is really interesting, because it's almost counterintuitive, right? Where you're like AI to help you be more human, right? It's almost in the relationship is kind of completely like a complete juxtaposition there. But, you know, in with some of those tools and how AI out of the gate is already, what are the risks, I think, in some of the ways that leaders are, you know, bringing AI in? I mean, every CRO is getting hit by their CEOs and everybody else. You know, this company over here is using AI. And also a lot of the AI tools are actually focused on the not human element, like the dark funnel or the things that you can't see or the buyer's intent, all those things that are out there to bring in the information. So just curious to think about, how would you frame that message to a CRO today in terms of how to think about that?
Well, and you think about it, it's a great question. Let's take intent data, for instance. you know, it's an advantage if you have it, if no one else does, but you know, these companies are out selling to everybody, right? So everybody has intent data and everybody have the same AI tools. The point is, at some point you're going to talk to a buyer. That's where the difference has to happen, right? And so one of the, you know, in my mind, and what I'm have seen and continue to see is sort of real disconnects is sellers think their job is to sell something when their job is really to help the buyer make a decision. Mm. And those are two distinct motions. And as long as sellers think that my job is to push my product and get you to buy my product, as opposed to really listen, understand what's most important to you as a buyer, and then help you make the decision to make the purchase decision, then we're always going to be sort of kicking along at the bottom of these, you know, absurdly low win rates that we have. And it's funny, you know, we've, especially in the SaaS world, these have become institutionalized, right? As people think, oh gosh, a 30% win rate, that's my top seller. And hey, when I was managing sales teams, you have a 30% win rate. I coached you to another profession because that wasn't acceptable performance. You know, and we've have a whole generation of sellers who think that it's okay, and they're doing okay if they lose more than they win.
You know,
as a seller, your minimum standard should be, I win more often than I lose.
Yeah. And it's not, Andy, we know, you know, you and I look at some of the same data here that, you know, most good sales organizations, the ones that are, you know, feeling like they're, you know, they're happy with what they're doing, you know, get to a level of 30, 35% win ratios. But that's not what could be. And you know what? I love that you just took us in this concept of, you know, seller, what defining a seller's responsibility, what they need to be doing in a successful go-to-market strategy. And I agree fully with you that it's working with, it's assisting the buyer through their process and making sure your product is positioned in the best possible ways and the information is shared back and forth. But I get amazed to this day, how many times now, how many sales effectiveness gurus, or they call themselves that, are out there still talking about how they have tools that will allow you to make your buyers see why they need to buy from you, or change their mind, or
oh yeah, persuasion. Yeah, and you know, I wrote about that in my last book. The difference between persuasion and influence, and I think persuasion is not a core sales skill, but one that perhaps is works to your disadvantage more often than not. Yeah, I mean, I think that people have to sort of stop for a second and really think about what's happening in the marketplace. Is again, you have this reported through multiple sources, massive dissatisfaction on the part of B2B buyers with sellers. And so if you're a salesperson and you're talking to a buyer, you have to ask yourself, well, why are they talking to me? It's not because they want to talk to me. It's because they need to talk to me, right? If they could do this without me, they would. So if you're in the position where you're selling a product, where you're actually engaged with the buyer, it's because they need to talk to us. So they need your help at that point in order to help them make their decision. So what do they need, right? That's really the starting point. Why are they talking to me? And I think there's been this mythology built up about, hey, you know, buyers are 80% of the way through their buying process before they talk to sellers. It's just not true. And if you believe it, and then you get people saying further, oh, well, you know, as a result, you can't influence the choices they're going to make. And again, just not true. And because your job as a seller at that point is, if the buyer's talking to you, is, you know, A, get out of your head about sales stages, because that's also, you know, unproductive for most sellers. think about the where the buyer is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they, and Gartner laid this out in their buyer enablement study, you know, 2018, 2019, everybody remembers the famous spaghetti diagrams or the Rube Goldberg diagram. What they found in their study was that almost at any point in that complex routing is if somebody brought a new perspective to the table, it could cause them to restart part of it, right? Whether it was an external source or sometimes an internal source, a new stakeholder is brought into the equation. They had a new perspective. Things could suddenly loop back and sort of repeat itself because they wanted to integrate this new perspective in. Well, that's really what buyers are looking for when they're talking to you at this stage, is they're still looking for help to understand what it is they can achieve, right? And maybe even to understand the challenges they're trying to face or the opportunity that exists for them to go after. And so I look at a buyer's decision sort of a sequential decision-making framework, which sort of has three parts from, and it's like very simple. It's, you know, what, how, and who. What is the problem we have and what are the outcomes we want to achieve by addressing it? When we define that, how do we want to accomplish our what? And the third order decision is, who do we want to do it with? And for sellers, if you're in that initial conversation with the buyer, you're really helping them understand what it is they're trying to achieve. That's what they need your perspective on. That's what they need your experience for. They, to your point earlier, Mark, they don't need your help understanding the products and the features.
Yeah,
but they need to help understand what it is, what's the possible. And so in that point, you know, sellers are pushing products without really understanding the buyer. And what's the point of pitching something if you don't understand the person you're talking to?
And I think even with the buyer, the buyer's, you know, it does feel like there needs to be just a giant reset of expectations and learnings in B2B enterprise software sales. Like with all of this happening, because two things happen. One is, you know, the old guys that have been around for a while, you know how, you know, most champions in these companies that are now promoted into a line of business budget owner who has the ability to at least champion a product through their company, right, through procurement process and everything else, we all know that might be their first time ever doing that.
Sure.
They don't know how to get that deal through their own company. They have no idea, right? Like they, you know, that's why deals slip. That's why they stall, right? You get to the end. Oh, I didn't realize I actually needed like three more sign-offs on this because this is the first time I've ever been responsible for procuring a piece of technology for my company, something like that. The AI tools I see out there now, right? And I had them, you know, at R3, their productivity is all about doing the same things faster, right? So, oh, you just had a call with the customer. We've just captured the notes, stuck it into CRM. Well, that you lose that opportunity to actually learn, go back and read those things. And to your point, where is my buyer? How experienced is that buyer? Where are they in their own journey within that company? So I think I think when people are hearing this, right, they're probably in the middle of this, right? If you're listening to this podcast, you're like, oh my God, I'm in the middle. I know exactly. I feel this. What advice would you give on kind of this convergence of like these events and leveraging, getting to down the road in some of these AI tools from a productivity sense?
Yeah. As the perspective for a leader is, it's not about the tools, right? It's about the customer. And do we really understand how to win their business? And that's, you have to start there. Yeah, I had this off and on conversation with this gentleman online who he had taken issue with me when I made the statement about sellers should win more than they lose. And he's like, hey, you know, I'm suspicious of win rates over, I don't know, 35% or something like that. I said, well, why? And this is a multi-time, according to his LinkedIn profile, multi-time CRO, multi-time, you know, exit type thing. I said, why do you say that? He said, well, because it means the sellers aren't having enough conversations. And you can sort of see this, this sort of logic, illogic, if you will, is thinking, well, gosh, we always need to be having more conversations. And really, it's sort of the opposite, right? It's once you've really dialed in, you've achieved product market fit, and you've really dialed in on your ICP, you don't want to have conversations with people outside that until you dominate that segment you're going after. If you've got, you know, 60, 70% market share, sure, start going to an adjacent segment. But in the meantime, you should be focusing all your energy on those people with the highest likelihood to buy. And you have experience demonstrating that you can sell to them. And so what's happened in startups in general, but specifically in SaaS, is look, we raise all this money, we need to scale. But we scale before we understand, before we have true product market fit, right? Because if your win rates are 30%, one of two things are at play. Either you don't have product market fit, or you just kind of suck at selling, right? You really don't know what it's going to take to help your buyers make the decision. And so you can't have it both ways. So really, you know, these tools that everybody's, you know, been using for 20 years, you know, not AI tools, but sales and technology, it's always been about more pipeline.
Right.
And I make the argument that, hey, if you've got a 5x pipeline coverage on your sellers, you've got more than enough pipeline. Your problem is not pipeline. Your problem is sales. You don't know how to sell. And this hurts people's heads when they hear this, but this is the hard fact. Is if you really have this number of prospects, win a higher fraction of them. Focus on that first, right? Really dial that in and then scale. I mean, when I join a startup, and whether it's, you know, it's full-time or it's running a bunch of companies or sales organizations as a fractional, the goal was, let's double revenue without adding headcount. Yeah. Because we didn't really, as I walked in there, they didn't really know how to sell the products they had. So let's focus on that. And then once you got that dialed in, you can scale very effectively and efficiently. But this is, you know, it's not been the mindset that exists. And so my fear, again, back with, you know, this new wave of tools, is yes, it will enable people to do more things. And I wouldn't confuse that with productivity. It just enables them to do more things. But the things don't lead to productive outcomes, meaning orders. So in a new book I'm writing, I create a new word. I sort of, it's a contrast between activities and productivities. And I think that any action that doesn't lead to a productive outcome, which is an order, is inherently unproductive. And you have to examine it and say, why are we taking this action?